Signal presents the Hacktivism Hour, a hive mind of hacktivists from all over Europe and the US. The hive will discuss the politics that are going on in Brussels and Washington, D.C. Hacktivism Hour. Resistance is futile.
Good evening at signal@hackerspaces.org. This is the Hacktivism Hour, basically a program about what kind of activism is going on, mostly in Europe, but some bits in the United States as well. Tonight we'll play some music, but also we have three separate interviews. The first one will be with Simona Levy, organizer of the Free Culture Forum, which took place last weekend in Barcelona. The second one is with Jamie Love, with Knowledge Ecology International, and apologies for starting off with using the wrong name for his organization. And the last one is Daphne van der Kroft of Bits of Freedom in the Netherlands. But first also some general news. There's loads of stuff coming up in Brussels nowadays. There's a consultation going on about so-called intermediary liability, basically ISP liability or hoster liability for stuff being hosted or stuff being pull through the tubes, to speak with a famous American politician by the ISPs. There is also a review of the Data Protection Directive, which is about privacy, going on. And there is also a new consultation coming up on data retention. But first on music.
Was there with me? I rode through the valley with the princess by my side. The duke and the duchess was there to meet me with a smile. Alice was there in the wonderland, staring far away. The street blind mice was there with me to tell the teddy bears the tale. Thank you. Alibaba, we the 46. Tom, Tom, the Viper's son, he was a damn with me.
You were listening to Alibaba Rhythm and Dub by King Dubby, a Creative Commons piece of music. And now our first interview with Simona Levy from XK Barcelona. Hello Simona, from XK in Spain, Barcelona. Simona, you organized a Free Culture Forum last weekend and also last year. What is the Free Culture Forum about?
The Free Culture Forum, first of all, hello to everybody, and then the Free Culture Forum is a gathering of, let's say, organization or people from all around the world, but unfortunately we cannot reach much the South America and Asia and Africa because of financial problem, but we try to make it even every year more international. But in any case, it's a gathering to talk about issues around the free culture and the rights in internet. The first year we were working on a legal issue. We were trying to work out some proposal to change the actual law in certain terms that make available the free culture and the respect of the rights in internet. And this year we focus more on the economical aspect, on the sustainability of the digital era and of the new forms of creation and distribution of culture, or the new form of collaboration in online or in general horizontal collaboration.
Okay, just for the understanding of the listener who has never heard of this before, what is the goal of the Free Culture Forum? Is it giving examples of legislation or more a guideline for politicians? Could you explain a bit more about that?
I think it's on different level, and it also depends on the people that come. We try to bring people that work in let's say three different level. One very practical. For example, in this case, this year was people that they were having a platform to produce or find financiation or find new way to produce it in a collaborative way. Then we try to bring lobbyists in the well sense of the word, let's say people that try to force government to legislate in a more just way, and also it's a way for us, it's a place to empowerment, for the empowerment of people, in the sense that you share and that you see that these issues, that they are often criminalized, or in any case that the effort that we, that civil society does to develop in more in a way that is more sustainable for everybody is a common effort. So let's say that we try to work on these three different levels: the people together, the legislation, and also the practical experience of what can be done.
Okay, may I ask a bit of a cynical question?
Yes.
Given that the current regime of copyright law and patent law is mostly broken.
Sorry?
Is mostly broken.
Yeah.
To what extent is it the responsibility of the communities in free culture, free software, etc.? To what extent is there a responsibility to come up with new business models? Isn't it up to the businesses who are failing to come up with new models themselves?
On this I have a personal opinion, I mean personal, from my organization, let's say, that what we think, I don't think it's shared with all the platform of the FC Forum and all the people that have come, but what, as an ex-guy, we think is that in the capitalistic situation that we are living in this condition right now, the struggle for the wages, the struggle for how to make a living is not a problem of the free culture, and it's a problem of the workers. There is a problem of not well distribution of wealth in general, and this is not a cause of the free culture. It's not a cause that people exchange things, because in any case, exchange facilitates always the growth of things. It is a real problem at the moment, but if we imagine the creation of culture as a business, of course we can feel that this as a problem. But since we don't want to think culture as a business, but we want to think that people with their skill, they have to find a solution to find a way to live, then it becomes a problem of, in general, of the how can we live in this society, and it's not the problem of the free culture.
So basically your point is that if we want artists to be professional artists, we have to come up with a funding model or multiple funding models for them.
No, I think everyone who want to live on something has, first of all, has to get paid when they work for a boss. So what we can see now very often in cultural institutions is that people doesn't get paid in name of the fact that they should be very happy to be presented in some cultural institution. And so, and often these institutions are the institutions that they make the discourse on free circulation, on how artists should be paid, can care, etc. So for me the problem is quite simple. When someone asks you to work for him, you should ask to be paid. And this is if you are a dentist, if you are an artist, if you are a baker, if you are a worker, if you are a cleaner, this is something that have to is in the domain of the exploitation. And then there is another domain that is the domain of doing what you like to do or being creative, or and I think it's two different things. Even Richard Stallman often, when he's asked, and this for me was quite interesting to see, when he was asked after his conference about free software, he was asked how you make your living. He just answered, "I don't understand the question," because we are in one side we speak about culture, and then we mix it up with the business, and it's two things that sometimes get together, but they are not ontologically together.
So your point basically is that the autonomous artist is doing something for its own or her own purposes, and should not be lumped together with anyone who's being hired in to some extent by some intermediary, be it a broadcasting company, a record company, or etc.
Yeah, or there is different way of making a living. I suppose that Madonna needs intermediary, but also I think everyone has to try to find the money. I mean, we need money to live in this society, so everyone has to find a way to get the money. And I think we should try to get the money where the money is. And the money is in the surplus of the collecting society, is in the bubble of the entertainment industry. So is there where we should go and grab this money. It shouldn't be criminalizing the sharing or criminalizing the collaborative creation. I repeat, for me it's very different thing. And when I am an artist, because I am also an artist, I get the money where the money is. So in the major institution, or is where the money has to be asked, not eliminating tools for the creation or making them unavailable or less open.
Okay. You mentioned collecting societies. Recently there's been an interesting court case about collecting societies in Spain, especially about levies on digital media. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, this is a very small shop here in Barcelona. They are also a member of our organization. And 6 years ago, it's a very small shop with the daughter, mother, and husband, and little dog, 60 square meter, and it's a shop of digital, hard disk, CD, etc., etc. And they were asked by the collective society 48,000 euros in for the last 4 years of digital levy, and applied before that the law was put in place. And so instead of getting scared and normally get to an agreement, that what the collecting society does is that they scare you with 48,000, and then they say, okay, let's do it for whatever, 15,000. And so you say, oh, thank you, that's very kind of you. They just fought back. And they fought back so far that they bring this to, after 6 years, it was to the Supreme Court of Luxembourg, of the European Union. And the five more important collecting societies of Spain were the attackers, the one who were putting the claim against the small shop, and the small shop won. And the case says that the application of digital levy indiscriminado is in Spanish, is not so indiscriminate, so with no without being careful that if it's for private copy or not, is not fair how it is done in Spain, and so that the practice that is done up till now in Spain, it's illegal, and all the law has to be reviewed. And already now, all the public administration, many of them are already suing to get the money back. So it's a huge changing of paradigm. It's in Spain there is a very aware civil society, very aware on these topics, and for us it's a great victory of the civil society against the lobbies and yeah, and a certain way of fear.
That is indeed very interesting, because in Germany you also have levies for digital media, and in Belgium you even have levies on printers, etc. And I can imagine this has to be reconsidered as well, given this Spanish case.
Yes, I think this is a start for major change in general. I think in Spain we are now going to have a major change on collecting society. This about the levy, it's a major change of all the concept of the EU directive on compensation of artists. And I think in this moment, Spain, it's really in a moment very interesting, and I think it can be an example for many other countries how things can change.
Well, sounds great. Thank you so much for this interview, Simona. And people who are more interesting can probably look at this up at xk.sp, I suppose?
It's .net.
xk.net. Okay, thank you.
Yes, thanks a lot to all of you.
Okay, bye-bye. You were listening to the song Fat 32 by Kulomek from his album Rekill. And the reason why we are playing this somewhat strange piece of music is that Kulomek was also playing at the Oxcars, which didn't discuss with Simona, but Simona also organized the Oxcars, which are basically a yearly set of awards for interesting pieces of culture in the free culture world, mostly Creative Commons music, Creative Commons films. And that was awarded at an event preceding the Free Culture Forum in Barcelona. Make sure you Google for the term Oxcars instead of Oscars. And it's an interesting phenomenon, to say the least. James, welcome in your show. And the first question, of course, is what is the Knowledge Environment International about?
Well, Knowledge Ecology International is a it's a nonprofit organization, and I guess a lot of people would describe us as a continuation of a couple of other earlier projects, which I also used to run. I've been doing this kind of work for around 20 years, and before that, I was running an organization. Well, actually, 20 years ago, I was running something called the for Ralph Nader, I was running something called the Taxpayer Assets Project, and that was a project that Ralph Nader had set up to look at the way government property was managed. And in that category, he included government databases and government inventions. And I started working on intellectual property rights issues as relates to government-funded medical inventions. And I also got to working on online access to government databases or access to government information in digital forms. That led me to a lot of other work involving the internet. And then around 1995, we set up something called the Consumer Project on Technology, which was had kind of a broader mandate. And starting around 94, we started doing a lot of work on international trade issues relating to intellectual property rights. And then around 2006, we actually spun off from the original organization I worked for and created KEI as an independent standalone organization, and we changed the name to Knowledge Ecology International.
Okay, thank you for the brief expose on your rather long history for this kind of activist group. I've seen you. Your organization has been very active in trying to make HIV medicine available for casualties of that terrible disease in the developing world. How did Knowledge Ecology International become involved in digital rights on the internet?
Well, I've always our early work actually started out with around the year 1990. It really started in work that was related to online access and internet-related issues, even before many people were using the internet. We were I was working on projects with library groups as to how you change United States policy back then on getting access to big government databases involving patent information or legislation pending before the Congress or databases about securities disclosure reports from big companies or medical databases, that sort of thing. I was doing that kind of work around 1990. We started working on medical issues about a year later in 1991. So we've always, even from the very beginning, worked on both the medical technologies and the information technologies. I think in many ways we thought those were really, really important areas of innovation for the world. And the issues about access and fairness and openness in all of those systems seemed to be important to us. So unlike a lot of groups that were either mostly on the internet or mostly on the medical area, we've always been one of the few that's really worked on both at the same time.
Okay, thank you. You've briefly spoke last weekend in Barcelona because you were attending the Free Culture Forum in Barcelona, and which was actually its second installment. And what, in your opinion, is the step forward which has been made during last weekend's Free Culture Forum in Barcelona compared to last year's Free Culture Forum?
Well, I think last year was the first one I was at. I enjoyed it quite a bit. They were looking for a much sort of wider set of issues last time in terms of this decoration that they worked on. The particular focus of this meeting seemed to be more on the way that you, the sustainability or the overlying economic underpinnings of how you pay for something that's free. I mean, it's how you support economically things that you want to be free on the margin. And so I think this one in my mind was more focused than the previous one on a narrower issue, where the other one I think covered a broader mandate.
And
is that kind of how you saw it, or maybe I missed something?
Well, I myself wasn't attending the ADIESI event. I was only mostly there for the ADRI General Assembly, so I'm therefore deeply curious about how things went. And on the show, we'll also have an interview with Simona Levy about it. Anyway,
yeah, there was quite a focus this time on the music issue, and particularly the flat rate proposal. And there was a number of people that were really opposed to that, and there were some people that were in favor of it, and there was kind of a back and forth on these issues. And I was a bit surprised in the meeting this time at how difficult it was to get progress on some real basic issues. It was fairly easy to get a consensus on something along the lines that most people would like to have the freedom to make copies of recorded music and to share them with other people and to create these sort of file sharing systems and that sort of thing for music, and we'd like to see those kind of systems be made legal and not the subject of litigation and threats of criminal action, that sort of thing. So that was the easy part. Then you get to the point of whether it's necessary or desirable for society to find some way to reward people or to move money to people that actually create these recordings in the first place, the sort of first copy problem. And at one point, it didn't even really seem like there was much consensus on that, wholly apart from how you did it. I mean, you could have some people could say, well, the intellectual property right would be a point of departure, or we'd accept something that was kind of a collective licensing thing, or there were some more radical proposals about completely kind of abandoning the copyright system per se, but creating alternative reward system which had a very different context and a very different set of values attached to them. And some people wanted state funding. You had a variety of different ways you might move money to people that that create valued works and productions in that area. But then there was other people that just felt like, well, you didn't need to do anything. It was not very expensive to create these works, and people had other ways of monetizing the cost or recovering the cost through live performances or building up their reputations, that sort of thing. So there was a pretty big difference of opinion about the need to do something in this area politically, and whether or not it was really even socially desirable to commit to some kind of reward system for people that create great recorded music.
Well, I'm wondering about it as well. To what extent do the various communities involved in this interesting project, either from the free culture world or from the free software world, have an obligation to create new business models because the traditional ones are failing and crumbling down?
Well, I mean, there's sort of two different ways of coming at this. One way to come at this is that the problems resolving to the widespread civil disobedience of copyright laws on the internet or widespread piracy or that sort of thing, leads to a counter reaction from the publishers and the copyright industries, and they use their political influence to try and get very kind of repressive laws or changes in the way the internet functions or tracking devices or criminal sanctions or, you know, there's kind of like a what was described by people as a war against sharing that is going on. And some people thought, well, you know, and I would one of them, that there's a lot of collateral damage and harm by these measures being put on the internet. I mean, if you continue to press for DRM type technology and technological protection measures, surveillance, legal liability, third party liability, you kind of built this big repressive regime. It's just not a good thing, wholly apart from the music, because it has affected all these other areas, and it's just kind of it's just not a very nice scenario for people, this kind of police state kind of environment. So in that sense, the idea that you could somehow get an agreement that people would pay a certain amount of money per month, you could argue about who would pay into it and how much they'd pay, but just that some type of a reward system that could eliminate that the need for those kind of repressive legal measures would be a positive thing, and that you'd also have the benefit of you know, a better livelihood for people that were in the that were working in these creative communities. A different way of looking at it is that you could assume that the legal mechanisms will all fail, that the publishers will be completely unsuccessful, DRM will fail, everything will fail, and that you don't have nothing to fear from the state, that the state is kind of helpless in the face of technological innovation in this area. That's another point of view some people have. But even if you think that's the case, then you're confronted with the issue of if you were to not have to pay and nobody had to pay and there was just no money and everything was being distributed for free on the, you know, and there was no real economy made out of recorded music anymore, would that actually be a good thing? I mean, is that like a good outcome? Does that put you where you want to be? And what makes it a little bit more complicated is you got the music scenario, which is one thing, which I think is a fairly manageable problem in comparison to looking at this issue as it relates to ebooks or movies or things like that, where it becomes, I think, much harder to think about what the solutions might be than the music area. In any event, it was, I think, an illuminating discussion. It was a very talented cast of characters that Simona brought to the meeting. It was very interesting to participate in it. I'm not sure if they're at a point of consensus yet.
Okay, well, let's hope that it can be achieved at some point in time. Talking about undue repression and collateral damage, we also have this lovely little thing going on with the so-called anti-counterfeit trade agreement. What's the status of that right now?
Well, the so-called anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which is just really a big intellectual property enforcement agreement that covers not only in its present form, not only a copyright and trademark infringement, but it also includes patents, infringement of patents. It includes geographic indicators, trade secrets, industrial designs, boat hull designs, all sorts of different things. It's just kind of a generic agreement among a wide range of, it's not really an agreement yet, it's a proposed agreement. And nobody's really signed yet at this point. It's the Europeans will have to decide if they're going to approve it. And I think the Commission is highly confident, but there is resistance within the Parliament, and there will be I think an important test that arrived at in the Parliament around the 11th or 12th of November, and then we'll have some sense of whether the Parliament is in a position to really block the European Union from agreeing to the agreement. And then you also have some resistance in the United States Senate and some executive departments in the United States as to whether or not the United States can sign it, because the negotiated text, the United States was trying to negotiate this under a legal authority that is only available if you don't change U.S. laws. And then the problem is the agreement that was finally, you know, the current version of the agreement would require changes in U.S. law. It would either require changes in U.S. law or some understanding that the agreement was kind of soft, that some of the precise obligations could be ignored by the United States. And if they could be ignored by the United States, you know, it's a little unclear whether or not they could be ignored by everyone else as well. So I'd say that the ACTA thing is procedurally is a bit of a mess right now. I don't think it's really crystal clear if the United States can sign it legally, and if the United States doesn't sign it, whether or not the Europeans would be willing to make changes in it to make it easier for the United States to sign it.
Well, I personally doubt that, because then you have the geographical origin indicators, which are kind of a no-no in the European Parliament right now. But that's just my opinion. You just mentioned that the Senate may or may not resist this. You just had an election with a shift of power. How may this affect this process?
Well, it's there was one very important member of Congress, Rick Boucher, who was defeated. It was considered an important person for having more balance in terms of the copyright issues and technology. And so I think people were really, it was unfortunate that he was defeated in his reelection bid. He's been around for a long time, and he's Virginia, he'll be missed. In terms of the overall changes, I'm not so sure that this is such a big area of difference in the broader picture. If you look at the if you look at the Democrats, have really been kind of hardliners on the copyright issues, for example, and there haven't been that many differences between the Republicans and Democrats in the United States Congress on a lot of these intellectual property issues. They've kind of been kind of equally old school and equally kind of repressive on both the Democrats and the Republican side. So I'm not sure. I mean, the election's going to have a lot of consequences in the United States. I'm not sure that it would change things as far as something like ACTA is concerned or some of the copyright policies. It certainly has made big business stronger, because you know, the Democrats have raised a lot of money and are pretty close to big business interests. But of course, the Democrats have been, you know, they've been pretty close to big business as well. Everyone is. The United States is under this sort of corrupt political system right now, where you can, there's unlimited campaign spending, and you don't even have to disclose it anymore, and it's just ridiculous. So you had people say that $4 billion was spent on the election. And, you know, the people that put up the $4 billion, most of them are just business lobbies and things, or, you know, special interest and things. So it's really kind of a bigger problem in the United States than just this this particular agreement.
Yeah, but special interests are a problematic phenomenon in Brussels as well. But basically, the conclusion I get from your remarks is that if you're against ACTA, it still is very worthwhile to let your members of the European Parliament know that that you're against, at least for our European listeners. This program is also listened to in the United States and elsewhere. I think we more or less got through our subjects, Jamie, and thank you very much for the patience with us, and as always, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, yeah, thank you very much for calling me.
Okay, we'll be in touch. Bye.
Design Branding Live.
Daphne, welcome to the show. Daphne is from Bits of Freedom. Nice to have you. And can you explain us a bit about what Bits of Freedom does?
Yes, of course. Bits of Freedom is the Dutch civil rights organization, and we spread for civil rights on the internet, to say it short. So this means there are two civil rights we are especially focused on, and that's the freedom of expression and privacy. And we do this by either lobbying or public actions. So if the lobbying doesn't work, we ask our fans and our supporters to follow us and have an action together.
Okay, that's interesting. How are you funded?
Well, Bits of Freedom... Bits of Freedom now... exists for a year again, and we had this fund by a special organization called Internet for All, and now that we've been active for a year, been quite successful, we ask our supporters to fund us. So there are three different columns for funding. First is the individual funding, then we have the companies that can support us, And at last, we have special funds that can support us for individual projects.
You recently had a funding drive, trying to get as many private donors as possible. How successful was that?
I'm very proud to say that it was very successful. So what we did, we asked all our supporters to help us get 1,000 donors in one day. This, of course, is a very high number. So it was very risky. We didn't know what to expect in advance, but it went great. Twitter exploded in the morning. Our servers were smoking before 11 o'clock in the morning. And it was terrific. I think the most important thing was that it was terrific to see how many people support us and really believe in the goals we stand for. So what we did, we asked people not only to give a donation themselves, but ask others to do the same. It's very simple, but it worked really well. So we're very glad that, because this means that we can actually continue our work for the following months. And there's a lot to do, so it's needed.
In the past, there have been a few insinuations that Bits of Freedom was less of a mouthpiece for normal citizens, but more of certain ISPs. To what extent does this successful donor drive disprove that?
Well, I think you already answered the question by asking me. Well, first of all, The first thing I would like to say about that it's books, because one of the main themes, one of the main issues we're working on is net neutrality, and Well, I don't have to explain you or your listeners that net neutrality is a very important way for ISPs to gain more more power and more more money. So if they would, if we would be a mouthpiece for the ISPs, we would do a very bad job. That's the first thing. And secondly, well, I think our donor actions proved that we really we are supported by the people that by the internet users themselves and not by ISPs or any other company.
Okay, what kind of advice would you give your sister organization or your fellow European citizens' rights organizations? Given this success, how could this be duplicated elsewhere in Europe?
Well, I think organizations like that resemble our organization here in Holland, we have we could have a huge impact because times are changing. We can see that more and more people are interested in these issues. Freedom and privacy on the internet were issues that you wouldn't read about in the newspapers or see on the 8 o'clock news. And now that's changing. So that's the first thing. And secondly, we have, of course, we have new methods of communication via Twitter and Facebook and mail and everything. It's so much easier to organize an important movement. And, well, we have proven in the last year that with a small amount of people that are working on a daily basis, but with a lot of volunteers, we can make a difference. We have been quoted in the government agreement, and this is only because we have such an such a loud voice now in the Netherlands. So I think, and you can see it with La Quadrature du Net as well. They're doing a great job, and other organizations in Europe could do the same. It's just finding a focus, and that's the most important thing. Find a focus. Find one or two issues that you really want to specialize in. Don't try to do too many things. And it's possible. We can prove it.
Okay, you just mentioned La Quadrature. One of the other, La Quadrature is an observer at EDRI. And there are several other European organizations with similar goals. You cooperated recently with La Quadrature with some modest success, as it appears to be. What was this all about?
What's it all about? Okay, well, last May, Mr. Kouchner and Mr. Verhagen, those were the foreign ministers of France and Holland, they got together and they said, well, we need a code of conduct for internet freedom, and they were looking at countries like Iran and China, and they were saying, well, freedom on the internet is so important, we should make a code of conduct to ensure this freedom. But the funny, could I say this, thing is, of course, that the freedom of on the internet in France and in Holland are at stake as well. So in the meantime, we had new elections here in Holland, so we have now a new Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Rosenthal, and he was planning to go to a meeting the 29th of October to meet Mr. Kouchner as well, but also people from other countries, civil society, companies, different stakeholders. But what happened? La Quadrature du Net leaked a letter from Mr. Sarkozy to Kouchner. And what did he ask? He said, please adopt the ADOPI law in this code of conduct. And ADOPI is the law which makes it now possible in France to be cut off the internet if you are illegally downloading three times. So first you get a warning, and after three times you get cut off the internet. So this is, it's preposterous, because code of conduct for freedom on the internet would be abused for this for this Adopilo. So after we read this letter, La Quadrature du Net and Bits of Freedom wrote open letters to their ministers, and well, we're very glad that Mr. Rosenthal finally said that he wasn't going to the event on the 29th of October. And he sent his ambassador, and of course, just in the diplomatic world, is a very clear sign that he doesn't want to be part, and he doesn't want to support such a harsh new law in the Netherlands and in Europe. So it was a very clear first test for Mr. Rosenthal. Would he be in favor of freedom on the internet, or wouldn't he? And well, we're glad to see that he passed the test. So we can see, well, we have won this battle. And of course, the battle for freedom of, on the internet is not, this fight is not won at once. You have to win it battle by battle. And, well, we're very glad to see that this battle is won.
Well, some good news at least. At least Sarkozy seems to have lost some face in this discussion.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking a bit about politics here, and also about giving money. But what could people contribute to this if they're not so much into politics or not so much interested in legal details, but are much more the hacker type of people who just tinker with stuff?
And well, the hacker type of people are so important to movements like ours, because what we regularly need is technical know-how and input on how it actually works. So what we have is different lists for different kind of volunteers. And one of these lists is specially made for people with a technical background. What they can do is they can go to our website, bof.nl, that stands for bitsoffreedom.nl, and they can subscribe to our mailing list for technical volunteers. And we would ask them on a quite regular basis for help and for input. And this can vary. This can be, for example, this can be a question on how they think about net neutrality. But it also could be the question on what are the dangers of using FireSheep or, well, these kind of questions. So it's very different, and it's very important to us because this adds to our expertise, and people take the movement more serious because of that. So hacker people, as you call them, can do quite a lot, and they're very important to us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Hacktivism Hour. The last two songs you heard were All Over the World by Stijn Branding, as well as Breath of Freedom by Zero Project. Have a nice night.